Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the study and welcome back. We began our study yesterday with an exploration of the situation of the people of Israel in Egypt, which in some ways can be summarized by the characters. Literarily, I think the book is introducing characters in these first chapters. First character we meet is the Pharaoh. Right? We met him as a person threatened, seeking to control, moving toward force, oppression. Then we met the midwives, Shifra and Pua. One of the things that was sort of interesting for me as I read back last night is the only mention we've had of God so far is that Shifra and Pua fear God. That's the only mention so far. Then we met, not by name, but a man from the house of Levi and a woman who have a baby. And the woman puts the baby in a basket after 3 months in the Nile. His sister watches out for him. The Pharaoh's daughter takes him into her house. And so we watch the irony kind of move as the Pharaoh intensifies the oppression. It becomes less and less effective, even counterproductive, almost comical in some ways, how the Pharaoh stumbles along. I promised you that today we would hear God's response. But just for the sake of being provocative, one of the questions I like to raise is, if you were God, if you were the God in whom you believe, okay? A God of grace, a God of love, life, justice, whatever words. Come on in. I think there's some folding chairs back here along the wall.
There's some regular chairs, too.
There's some regular chairs back there? Okay. Welcome. If you were God, how would you respond to this situation? What would you do? I deserve that from yesterday. Anybody want to venture? Anything?
Oh, sure. I'll get started. If I were God, I would smite Pharaoh dead, and his firstborn would be a person of justice and would rise up as the new Pharaoh and free the Israelites.
Okay. But not until you had destroyed Pharaoh. Good. That's great. Any other reactions? How many of you would need the word destroy, kill, smite, condemn in your response? I asked this at my conference when we study Genesis, after we read Genesis 1 through 11, and we've learned about the rebellion against God, the brokenness of creation. Then I say to them, now if you were God, how would you respond? And I get sort of two categories of response. Some of them are hopelessly naive. The ones that say, well, I just let it work itself out. Time heals. You know, they parrot some of these things. Or I would just sit them all down and we would talk it through. You know, I get those sorts of responses. But about 4/5 of them, I would venture a full 80% are just gonna wipe the place out. You know, just destroy it. And it's amazing how creative some of their writing is. One of them said one time, I'd stop the world spinning on its axis, and half the world could freeze, and the other half would boil. I always start confirmation by telling them they ought to be glad I'm not God. At that point, I said I was glad she wasn't God, too. For those of you who insist on calling God she, don't assume that's a more nurturing character. So anyway, today we're gonna look at the text to stir our own imagination for how the ancient record says God responds. I think I actually misspoke yesterday. When we did 1 through 11, I talked about how God moves toward particularity. I mean, in fairness, I should have said the Bible moves toward particularity. The Bible makes that move to talk about one man, one woman, one baby, right? God hasn't done anything yet. The only mention we've had of God so far. Now, the Bible intensifies the move toward particularity at 2:11. Go to 2:11. One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, teenagers love that. He looked this way and that. If nobody sees you, right? That's not a new insight. Every generation thinks they're the first ones that have ever discovered that. Seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When Moses went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together, and he said to the man that did the wrong, "Why do you strike your fellow?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. Okay? I mean, we aren't the only ones who have these destructive kind, judgmental, condemning, killing kinds of impulses. Moses himself has that. Then the Pharaoh has it back. Things on that level just degenerate altogether quickly. The movement I hear in the text that I just want to take a moment to emphasize is that it's not merely that the text works with the particular one person, this one baby who is now grown, but the text moves toward the unlikely. If you were going to choose, if you were God, and you were going to choose someone to help your cause, would you choose someone wanted for murder in the country where you want new justice? Or would that be about the last person you would choose? And I emphasize that because I think that's such a powerful and intense biblical theme, this movement toward the unlikely. If you're going to start a nation, populate the world with your own covenant people, do you choose people in their 90s? You know, or if you're going to announce the birth of your Messiah, do you choose shepherds? You see what I mean? We move forward or backward, and we encounter this again, that there are commentaries that somewhere between verse 10 and 11 write chapters about all the military strategy Moses must have learned because he grew up in the Pharaoh's house. Well, for the life of me, I don't know where those scholars get that. Did you see it there? Between being pulled out of the river and killing the Egyptian? I didn't see it either. And the reason that concerns me, I mean, those interpreters also have the right, and no doubt, Moses has learned some things about being Egyptian. And that we can imagine. What the text tells us is that Moses knows he's Hebrew. Moses knows he's an Israelite. That's what the text is emphasizing. And I think the problem I have with the commentaries who want to make him, who talk about military strategy, is they want to make him Charlton Heston. Mm-hmm. You know? The right, the perfect, the strong, the... And turn our focus on a Moses who's going to just... And I don't hear the text going that direction at all. I hear the text going to the least likely. Already highly unlikely. And then wanted for murder, that just ups the ante, doesn't it? So we got Moses fleeing. And we've got this long expanse of time. There is a man in our study in New Ulm last year who was marvelous for, for good discussion, what you really need, Carol, is somebody who's mad at the text, okay? That happened at 7:45, though not yet. This guy was mad because he said, how can God allow this to continue? I mean, we've got these expanses of time here. We have a baby, and then he's grown, and now he's fleeing the country, and in the meanwhile, the baby boys are being killed. People are building store cities for a Pharaoh who thinks himself a god. I think intensifies and gives us the other side of a verse, the Lord slow to anger the Bible says. It's like, come on, God, get angry. You're going to say.
I guess one of the things, I see this as pretty comical in that, you know, the text specifies that Moses is looking this way and that. And yet he forgets that there's going to be a survivor when he kills the Egyptian.
Yeah.
And people talk. So it kind of has Moses being dull.
I think so too. So human that way, forgetting that there's a consequence, whether or not you're seen, in a consequence in terms of your own integrity, if nothing else. Well, Moses flees to the land of Midian, is married, has flocks, life is moving along swimmingly for Moses. The children of Israel are groaning in Egypt. We'll pick it up at 2:23. In the course of these many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned under their bondage. And this is one of the other haunting descriptions, I think a true description of the power of brokenness or of evil. The Pharaoh is the one who started it, but though the Pharaoh dies, the brokenness continues. The bondage, the damage, it just goes on. And the people of Israel continue to groan under their bondage and cried out for help. And their cry under bondage came up to God. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abram, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew their condition. Remember, we said yesterday we want to pay attention to what's repeated. And I think it's a marvelous text for this week in the village when our deaf sisters and brothers are among us and we get this multi-sensory description of God. God heard it, and God remembered, and God saw, and God knew. Saturday we had a teacher's meeting to, you know, to prepare for the week, and one of the things we were sensitized to is how many times without thinking we use hearing language. Well, here I am, the Bible study leader, and I always talk about hearing the text, listening to the text. So yesterday, just discipline to say, pay attention to the text. You see, and how marvelous it is to have the opportunity to see words, to learn to see words. See, that there's a kind of contradiction, but we, you know, soda pop. You see it as well as hear it. And we have this description of God. God hears, and God remembers, and God sees, and God knows. A marvelous contrast to where we started yesterday. Started yesterday with a Pharaoh. What did it say of the Pharaoh first? Who did not know. God knows. Okay? Who's got power? Where is the power? To deepen this further, the word to know in the Old Testament is the word for sexual intimacy. And Adam knew his wife, and she conceived. I yearn for that to be the word for sexual intimacy in our culture. To know the one with whom we are intimate. That sex is unknowing. That is an aside. But it is also a description of a God who knows the people and their condition and their growth. Any comments, reactions? Go ahead.
I'm not sure if I'm correct on this, but isn't this the first time that it's mentioned that the Israelites called out to God? And I'm wondering, with our comments before about God being slow to anger, doesn't he respond when we know our situation, call out to him, and then but he doesn't act if we don't truly know our situation and don't call out to him? I don't know if I'm...
Is God's knowing dependent on our asking? That may say more here than I'd be ready to say, but it is true. It's the first time they've asked for help.
He's acting. I mean, he knows all, but he's acting upon that. He waits
on
for
that
us
request
to know our situation,
to know ourselves,
and to know that we need him to get us out of it.
Yeah, or that we need change. that we need to be changed. Thank you for your comment. Appreciate that. Other reactions? Okay, now we're going to meet this God, as God meets this Moses. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law in chapter 3, verse 1. Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Hear the movement toward particularity. This is the place, this is the time, this is the event. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. Then he said, do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abram, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. On Friday, when we'll get to the new covenant on Mount Sinai, that's chapter 20, I'm actually going to start with chapter 19, which is another one of these appearances of God. Theologians, biblical scholars call a theophany. God appears, God shows God's self in this bush that burns but does not consume itself. And I think I would like to discuss some of the mysterious revelatory dimensions of that then, sort of let it be for now. For here, what we'll pay attention to is what God says about God's self. God identifies God in terms of God's history, of God's memory. The God of Abraham and Sarah, the God of Isaac and Rebekah, the God of Jacob and Rachel. I told you yesterday, I keep changing my mind about what the book is about. It makes me wonder. Tomorrow you'll hear this more intensely. It makes me wonder if the book isn't about memory, about remembering. The key to freedom is to remember. It says God remembers. Pharaoh forgot, but God remembers. God identifies God's self by God's memories of what God has done, what God has committed God's self to. The power of history here is poignant, I think, something we really want to pay attention to. But God keeps speaking. Then the Lord said, I've seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. Okay? The same repetition again. The same sense verbs. Seen, hear, known. The writer doesn't want us to miss that. God is paying attention to God's people. And I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I've seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. If I were God, I would send you. What a splendid idea. What do you think of that idea? It's a great passage to teach in the Midwest, where you've got lots of parishioners who herd cattle. You know, they are sheep herders. They cannot imagine going to Saddam Hussein or the United. You know, who, me? I mean, they don't like meetings. It's one of the reasons they're farmers. They work for themselves with animals. Who are wonderfully predictable, or you send them to market. I mean, I envy them. How about you? God says, I'll send you. What do you think of that idea? Come on, you guys.
He's sending us all every day.
Uh-huh. Yep, there it is. Thank you.
Well, I kind of do what Moses does and says, huh?
Well, Moses says more than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Moses said to God, who am I? Who, me? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? God said, but I will be with you. I think it's really crucial here. This is pattern. Moses objects probably four times, depending on how you count. The argument goes now for a couple chapters. To hear on what terms God responds to Moses' argument. Does God respond in terms of Moses? You can do it. Come on. Take a workshop in self-esteem. You know? You are able, or you're just, you know, you grew up in the Pharaoh's house. Come on, you've had these experiences. Put them to use. You've got these gifts. Theologians, I mean, we'll use the word anthropocentric, human-centered. That's a human-centered point of view. One of my mentors, when I was going out to student teach, she was a teacher, said, Paul, always remember you know more than they do. Had the dreadfully humbling experience of learning that's not true. It's important to listen to the people you're teaching because sometimes they know more than you do. And that centeredness on us is not where the text goes. Moses says, who, me? And what does God say? I will be with you. The argument advances not in terms of who people are, who Moses is, but in terms of who God is. A radically theocentric, God-centered approach to daily life. Thank you for that. To our calling to live this day, not in terms of who we are, but in terms of who God is. Okay? I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. Moses himself is the sign. That's interesting. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. One of the things I most love about this book is the way the rhythm of the book goes between action, or dialogue in this case, and worship. Something happens and the people worship. They get an announcement and the people worship. They get, you know, they get delivered. And they drag out their drums and they sing and dance and they worship. The purpose of the deliverance, the purpose of the freedom is for worship. Not accidental to life, not incidental, not an afterthought, but the very purpose that in worship come to acknowledge as well as know the God in whom all depends. Comments? Questions?
It's not a very reassuring sign that later you'll know that this is all right because you'll come back to this mountain. The human in me doesn't get that. That's very reassuring.
You're not very reassuring. What do you need?
Well, actually, it's just not very earthly. It's not something you tell somebody else. See, this is a sign of power. We're going to go back to that mountain. That does not translate on earthly terms, yeah, into anything you really understand. But God still isn't addressing Moses' concerns and what Moses accepts.
You had something more tangible. Mm-hmm. The big argument we had at 7:45 was over the Benny package. You know, but what about the benefits? What kind of deal is God cutting Moses? And someone advanced the case that Moses was getting a raw deal.
Yeah, he did.
Which prophet didn't?
He didn't. Which prophet didn't? Yeah.
And which prophet wanted to?
Well, but you see, the good thing about the discussion is because the objection is so real. It's this yearning for the tangible. I mean, this is a person who's read the book, knows Moses doesn't even get to cross the river. And that seems really rude. And you know, I feel for Moses intensely. It is a job he doesn't want. But I think there's so much here for us to gain vocationally, to use that word instead of job word. Vocation is our calling. It is our God-given calling. Some of us are fortunate enough to have our jobs be that calling. I mean, I really think we need to see our jobs in terms of that calling. But we have other callings. We have the calling to be neighbor, to be spouse, or to be parent. I mean, these are other callings. And many of these callings also have real thin benefit packages. Parenting. You know, somebody said, what if this was an ad on the internet? Who would risk 40 years in the wilderness and then you die? You know, preceded by the fact that the Pharaoh has hated you and the people have hated you and you never do quite understand the God who got you into it. But think about an ad for parenting. 18 years, 24 hours a day. Need teaching skills, nursing skills. You know, all these skills, and there are no guarantees. Except that the outcome will be human. And, you know, the Bible has all kinds of things to say about that. Is there more you want to say about that? I thought I saw some hands waving. Go ahead.
You said that Moses himself is the sign?
No. I said that, but the sign is that they get out and worship God upon the mountain. I heard it wrong myself when I was reading stuff. Made the comma a period. So, the sign is that the people will be delivered. Yeah, fair correction.
You know, Moses got a raw deal, but then I'm really stuck on these midwives. I just like them so much, but they could have gotten a raw deal. They could have gotten killed, and yet there they went up to the Pharaoh and said, "What they did, you know." Women are strong.
Yeah. But the thing that's so interesting about discussion is that it stirs around the negative. We talk about what Moses doesn't get. And by George, we've all got an opinion. You know, we can all think of something else that would have been fair and right and, you know, certainly he could have expected. And the danger of that kind of discussion is that we miss what God or what Moses does get. Moses gets the promise that God will be with him. And so do we. And there are all the Psalms that speak about the sufficiency of God, the sufficiency of God's presence. We want to say that, but we so easily get stuck in the Benny package. And I like to do it with other relational categories. If I said to any one of you, I will be your friend, and you said back, yeah, but what are the perks? Or where are the benefits? Or what kind of deal are you cutting me? How would I feel about this friendship? Ikkebra. The Norwegian word is ikkebra. In friendship is one of those places where we have the ability to see that the relationship is sufficient in and of itself. And when it brings other gifts, that's wonderful. And when it doesn't, that's okay too. The presence is the gift. The presence of another who knows one. And that's what God is about here, saying, I know you. And I know your circumstances, and I will be with you. And faith is the gift to let go of the guarantees and say, thanks. Glad to have you along on the journey. I mean, that's really important before we get to tomorrow's discussion, because there's nothing left for Moses or for the people or for the Egyptians except this power working itself out in the most incredible kinds of ways. Well, God still shows us a little more of God's self. We'll keep reading. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is God's name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. The Hebrew word Yahweh, transliterated Jehovah, God's great name. I am who I am. Now we already know, even from this book, that names in the Bible are important. They describe identities. Moses is named drawn out of the water. That's descriptive of what Moses will do. So what does God's name tell us of God? I am who I am. I loved it Sunday night at Eucharist. I don't know if all of you were in the village yet then. They're celebrating the anniversary of Fullness of God Lutheran Church and said, sometimes known as Fog Lutheran Church. I've long said, fog is a theologian's weather of choice. You know? What do we see in this name? And well, I appreciate the commentators who are courageous enough to say, when God reveals God's self, God somehow manages to hide more than God shows. And never more clearly than when God becomes human to reveal God's self. Because then God doesn't look like God at all. God looks like human. Go ahead.
To me, by him saying that, to me it's total strength, total certitude of who he is, where he came from, where he's going. It's total knowledge and understanding. I mean, it's just, this is it.
Yeah.
Anything else would be more limiting.
Beg your pardon?
Any other description would be more limiting.
Yeah.
I've heard this also translated, I will be what I will be. Mm-hmm. How do you argue, I guess?
Yeah, God is free to be God. Go ahead.
I was just thinking too, I don't think we could conceive if he could tell us.
Yeah. I think too, it is descriptive of the otherness of God. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. I need to do more work on this, Hebrew-wise. But I'm eager to test it out. Poland is a place you get to test some of the edges you're not through with. If it would be fair to say, there is a statement here of integrity, of God's integrity. I am who I am. And I cannot be other than I am. Unlike humans, for whom we get two-faced descriptions, right? Able to be one thing and do another, claim one thing and, you see? Able to be other than who we are. But here is God, who is only able to be what God is able to be. I hope it's true. It's helpful for me. And I think helpful when the truth is really painful, and when the movement is really hard, when tough love is really tough love, but necessary for the sake of truthful integrity. In a world that's ready to make God's love soft, I think that's a really important edge that I don't want to let go of.
I guess to me this says that he's saying I am unalterable. I'm not going to change.
No.
Fair to hear that. I think one of the things that is in tension with that in the text is God's responsiveness to the people's suffering, God's involvement, and God's knowing that I at least want to talk about a movement of God, if not a change of God. We've got that behind us. Ahead of us, we do have some marvelous moments. I didn't pick them for this study, but read them on your own. When God repents, God is slow to anger, but God gets angry. And I think in worlds of injustice and oppression, we need that kind of anger. And there's the place where God says, I'm going to wipe them out, this is it. And then Moses goes to plead the case of the people. And it says, and God repents. God turns around. So, I mean, there are some other voices in the text that may want to influence them. The changes in God cannot undo what God has been. God is who God is. That's what we hear it saying. So there's a sense of movement and constancy. You know, that's paradoxical. We want to hold those together. Okay? And God said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Thus I am to be remembered. Thus is a purpose word in the scripture. You will be delivered, thus you shall worship God. I have given you my name, thus you shall remember throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will hearken to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the Pharaoh of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now we pray you, let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. That's an interesting verse to pay attention to as we enter the plague discussion, that the initial request is to leave Egypt for 3 days. Okay? It is not a request for absolute freedom. It's just a request for a long weekend.
They've gotten all the way to Mount Horeb and worshiped God in 3 days.
I don't know.
Earlier there, he said that they were going to do that. Is God purposely setting up a trick? Tell them a little lie here.
Well, there is. I think playing a trick and lying are two different things. There is a place in the plague narratives where God acknowledges he's making sport of the Pharaoh. Interesting description. Making sport of him. The book is not devoid of humor. We should not be so horrified by the horrors. I mean, it is horrible that we miss some of that humor. But what will happen, we'll watch it happen tomorrow as we read the plagues, is that it keeps intensifying. It starts out with this 3-day request, and then the Pharaoh gets to the point where Pharaoh's gonna grant that, and then his heart is hardened. But that's tomorrow's discussion. Just notice how the initial request comes. 3 days, so that you may worship God. I know that the king of Israel will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. I know it's gonna be a power struggle. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all the wonders which I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor and of her sojourns in her house jewelry of silver and gold and clothing, and shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. Thus shall you despoil the Egyptians. A benefit package. There it is. The Egyptians are even going to hand over their riches. God is a lavish God. Deliverance would be enough. But the spoiling of the Egyptians, which interestingly will become the spoiling of the Israelites too. And pay attention, they will make use of the gold. And I tried and tried and tried to figure out some way I could do 5 sessions and get the calf in here. And we're not going to get to the calf, so we'll have to do that one on the boat. Wouldn't the folks from Stehekin wonder about us? There's a person at 745 who made I thought, a really marvelous observation about the security of God when God says, I am who I am, which is its own power description. Family systems folks would call that differentiation or self-esteem identity, that Moses is so insecure. Who am I, he says. And that's his first reaction. And we haven't even gotten to his speech impediment yet or to any of these other kinds of objections, the insecurity of Moses. And the thing that it triggered in me was the way we started with the insecurity of the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh's afraid these slaves are going to rise up against him sometime. And so we've got these insecure characters in battle, and where is the power? Moses is given the promise of power. Trust the power. And it may be important that Moses is an unlikely candidate. That there's kind of little to nothing in Moses' character we can go to say, well, this is why he was chosen. So that it's more clearly the power of God that's revealed. Any reactions? Questions?
Maybe Moses was chosen because of his humanness. And that's a message for all of us. We don't have to be a super person. We can just be who we are and work with the gifts that we have.
Mm-hmm. Or it kind of reminds me of this little saying. It says, God does not call the equipped, he equips the called.
That's true.
God does not call the equipped. God equips the called. Thank you. Other reactions? Well, we'll skip the signs. There will be signs to deal with tomorrow. And the speech impediment by which Aaron gets to come along, the brother of Moses, comes to be the spokesperson. And let's pick it up.
Just on that, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
There was a verse here that we just read said the elders of Israel will go with you to the Pharaoh. I don't remember ever reading that before. But later on, does Moses go by himself with Aaron?
I'll have to check that out. If they ever go as a cadre?
Yeah.
I don't recall off the top of my head if that ever happens. I'm still groping for how to work with the plagues. So I'll be rereading them tonight. It's just because I know we can't read all of them. And I didn't expect, last year I told you I read this in our parish, in our adult Bible study program, and I didn't expect to read all the plagues then either. I thought we'd read a couple of them and then I would summarize. But we stuck with it, and it was really powerful to read them. Again and again and again. I mean, I plan to say this at the end, but I can just say it now. I like to think of it as a Bible study for stubborn people. Taught, if I may be so bold, by an expert. Okay? So if nobody comes back, I'll know. Or if word gets out that this Bible study is for stubborn people and the place is jammed, then we'll know. But in the meantime, we get this marvelous interlude, starting with verse 27, 4:27. There aren't a lot of happy interludes in the book, so I thought we ought to conclude this morning with this one really marvelous happy interlude. The Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him, and all the signs which he had charged him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses, and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, and that he had seen their affliction. See, you hear what I'm saying about the pattern? Anything happens, and then we worship. That I think that the text itself gives us the rhythm that needs to be our life. Somebody, I mean, I point to you because they were sitting in that chair last hour, talked about, you know, the way Moses had been equipped in his Hebrew heritage when we were on the, Moses knew himself to be a Hebrew piece. I think what's more powerful for me in the book is the way Moses needs to be constantly re-equipped, daily re-equipped, daily reminded. I mean, Moses is no picture of constancy or fidelity. He bounces back and forth. But this rhythm of coming back to God, be it in plea or in thanksgiving, re-equips and re-strengthens and reinvigorates the people. But it's so great. I mean, it's one of the nicest things the book ever says about the Israelites. They said it, and the people believed. I mean, every pastor's dream at stewardship time. I give you tithing. Why not? He said it, and they believed. And, you know, there's some, you know, one of the places I'm at in my ministry is to focus not so much on believing the Bible. Let me finish the sentence. I don't want you to mishear that. To focus not so much on believing the Bible as on reading the Bible. Because the marvelous thing about that is the way reading is incomplete and keeps belief moving and follows belief through all kinds of gyrations. The problem with believing the Bible, the problem I have in discussion with people who believe the Bible, is they get it settled. And it's kind of interesting in the book how you'd only need one chapter. We could have chapter one, and we love the midwives. They just decided to disobey. Well, what do you do about oppression? Pay it no heed. Believe the way Shifra and Pua believed. Okay? And it's settled. Right? Or you get to the next chapter. You know, God hears it. Okay. Good. But you see, the text itself moves us on. And for the time being, for this moment, moves us upward. I mean, if not on the mountain, at least lifts their heads in worship. They believed and they worshiped. It's kind of like when your adolescent says, thank you. You know it's not over yet, but it's just so great to have it happen for one moment. So we pause here at the end of chapter 4 to say, amen. The people believed, but the people both kept listening and kept forgetting to listen. And the Pharaoh, of course, isn't ready to listen at all. Here I am using all hearing verbs again. The people pay attention for now, but they're not consistent about that attention. And the text is going to challenge this belief, or it's going to be honest about Bible-believing people who need to continually be re-equipped and for that matter, emptied, because they forget and wander and all these other things. We've got a few minutes yet for discussion. Go ahead.
Well, I think I'm sure Moses, if God was with Moses and Aaron here, that it was very moving what they said, and empowering these slaves and reminding them of their heritage. And it comes up other times in Exodus. There's times when that's easy to believe, and you can get the trouble is when you actually try to act it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, what it really means, you've got to leave your home and go without food and water, and then you're going to get plenty of grumbling. And I think that's the test for all of us. Sure, it's great to go listen to a Sunday sermon and get inspired, but then can you really do it?
And the text gets even more specific than that. It will say, and what happens when you try to do it? What happens when Moses goes to Pharaoh? Anybody know what the first response is?
Get out.
The Pharaoh says, get back to work and do it without straw if you think you've got it so tough. So the people not only have their bondage, it gets worse. It's a passage I use sometimes when I'm counseling people who are seeking to claim a truth they need to claim, like in relationship, and they feel really good about it. Feels really good to say, yes, this is who I am. This is what I believe I need to do. And then they go and say it, and it gets worse. You know, that's why I think it's so important to keep reading the text. When we assume we're going to believe and it's going to get better. It is going to get better. It's a word of life. It's a word of deliverance. It's a word of hope. The thrust of our worship. But to climb any mountain, you go down a valley first. Yeah, go ahead.
Very similar with persons you're trying to break from an addiction. You know, in the Midwest, the popular one I know in North Dakota was alcohol. Mm-hmm. And people would go to Alcoholics Anonymous, or they go to treatment, go to AA. They're getting their life back together. They're working the program. It's you know, causing healing for them. But then they come back to you and say, we've got all kinds of family problems now. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to the person and then talk to the family, what has happened is the family, even though they didn't like him or her when they were drinking, they adjusted to it and built a system around it. Now they got this new stranger in their midst who they don't know, and they don't know how to respond to this person. So it isn't automatically, instantly, happily ever after. There's a valley that has to be traveled as they get to know who this new person is, who isn't bombed all the time, you know, and it's an interesting process, because I was naive enough to think early on that quit the drinking, the family will be healthy again, you know. Mm-hmm. Eventually, many times, yes, but there has to be a growth together again.
Yeah. I like to use the metaphor of blindness. Alcohol, in a way, is blinding. The alcoholic cannot see. Any addicted person cannot see. Sobriety is a gift of sight, and it's a good thing to see, but a lot of what you have to see is real ugly. That's probably why you're drinking in the first place, you know? The gift of sight, and so that's why Lutherans cling so closely to a law-gospel dialectic. The law has some really awful things to show us. It's a gift to see them. You can't change it without seeing them. And we've got another power by which we see them. That's the gift of 12 steps, the higher power by which you face not only the drinking, but every other problem. And that's really where that's centered. But it does not immediately get better. Go ahead.
I'm wondering, when Israelites heard, you know, all the things that Moses and Aaron said, if they weren't like the rest of us, we want perfection this side of the grave, we've got the answer.
Yeah.
And that's not the way it is this side of the grave.
Yeah.
We all want perfection this side.
Well, and I think it's the kind of thing that often happens at workshops or retreat. You know, you get a new approach. And in theory, it looks so good, and you role play it, and it's just wonderful, and you get all fired up, and you go back. The presiding bishop of the ELCA has a great little book out, A Good Time to Be the Church, just four little chapters. It's really wonderful. He talks about college faculties. He was a college president first. He said, college faculties are all in favor of progress. It's change they can't handle. You know, it sounds so good and it feels so good. And, you know, I mean, I could have stretched four chapters over five lectures and we could have just ended here. So see? The people believed and they worshiped. Amen, let's go to Vespers. But then where the story ends, and it's why I really want to be talking about reading the Bible. You hear the difference? Instead of believing the Bible is able to stop. It's able to get it settled right here. And reading the Bible has to go on to face the stubbornness of the Pharaoh. Who will we find ourselves to be like tomorrow? Go ahead.
It kind of ties into what you said earlier about the passage of time, that people are suffering what if it's what if God's purpose is not necessarily the end result, but the process, and God's purpose is to let the people realize they are powerless without God, and it takes until they call out and request the help from God before God hears and listens to them, like, pays attention to what they're doing, and you know, he thinks they're just going to go out and look at this 3 days of worship, but it's going to become a process. So, and what Moses is offered is a process of learning to become intimate with God, really the most intimate relationship with God of anybody in the Holy Testament. So.
The most frustrating thing about the book of Exodus, we won't get to study this either, is that it doesn't end. I mean, it's one of those lousy books. I hate books that don't end, you know? They just leave you kind of hanging. But it has caused me to rethink how glibly we say eternal. What does eternal mean? Without end. And you know, we delude ourselves in all kinds of ways, this side of the grave, wanting perfection, which in some ways may mean wanting an end, you know? Wanting everything to be in its proper place, and just right, and complete. And God doesn't give us that, God gives us eternity. God says, if even when you're dead, it's not over. And don't worry if your calling takes your life. He's taken care of that. And fear not even death. There is no end. There is process. There is life. There is continuation.
There's a building of a relationship.
Yeah.
What you're doing is building a relationship.
And community. End is community. Kathleen Norris's book, Cloister Walk. Any of you seen that? One chapter, I don't remember what the chapter is called, but one of the monks takes her out in the cemetery and says, I want to introduce you to the rest of the community. It's really marvelous. And I think it ties in with this book where we're bumping against memory every time. I mean, the Pharaoh's long since dead, but the oppression continues. Abram and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Rachel, long since dead, but the memory of covenant sustains. So that's pushing it this way. Hope pushes it this way, to say it's not going to end. Enjoy the ride, right? It's not going to end. We really don't want it to end fundamentally. We want the calling, the transition. Then when you're in the middle of it, you can't imagine what you've done.
Well, I think we all want to be comfortable and secure. And God is always pushing us to be on the edge.
Yeah. When Bishop Anderson, George Anderson, does his lecture on change, he did this in our synod, he talks about when somebody gives you a shove, and he does this thing, and he says, you think you saved yourself from falling on your face. Everybody else knows you finally took a step forward. And, you know, that is change. And we don't, you know, we like to think we're going to dance gracefully into it and plan it and anticipate it and all that kind of thing. God probably knows God needs to shove us. That's the next question the bishop raises is, what if it's God who gives you that shove? Even into this day, this day's calling, this community, these people, these strangers, this particularity. If the Bible will be that specific about Mount Horeb, why can't we be that specific about Mount Buckskin? God is here with us, we say. Pushing or pulling or calling, transforming. Well, you're so eager to just get back to the grim stuff, I thought we'd just bask in the ice cream of the people believing and worshiping. Tomorrow we'll read some of the plagues. I'll try to do some things with the sweep of the plagues. And so if you're game, start with chapter 5, continue reading through 11 or 12. Our readings will actually start in chapter 7. So if you don't think you can handle 7 chapters, read 5 chapters. Go in peace. Thanks, Billy.